KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. We can't predict when the next big earthquake will hit or how big it will be, but we can control what becomes of our cities in the aftermath. Construction techniques used in Japan are making buildings safer and capable of withstanding stronger quakes. But so far, Americans haven't been willing to pay the price for that kind of safety. We'll talk about the risks and the costs. And then at 9:30, the Trump administration is pressing ahead with its plan to impose a 5% tariff on all Mexican imports by this Monday, unless Mexico steps up border enforcement. But the proposal has little support among Republican lawmakers, and we'll get the latest developments and talk about what the tariffs would mean for U.S. consumers and the economy. And that's all next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. When a major earthquake hits the Bay Area, experts say big cities may be out of commission for months. And that's likely won't be the case in Japan, where they're constructing buildings that not only can survive earthquakes, but also remain functional. That's thanks to advances in technology that allow the ground to shake but keep the building still. And the technique, called base isolation, is used in thousands of buildings in Japan and in several other countries vulnerable to earthquakes, but not here. New York Times reporter Thomas Fuller joins Forum in this segment to discuss what he learned about the reasons why. And Tom Fuller, welcome back to Forum. Good to have you.
No, thank you, Michael. Such an important topic.
It is indeed. I agree with you. We've been talking a lot about wildfires. We forget about how inevitable an earthquake is, a big earthquake. And your article really fleshes out just how far ahead the Japanese are as far as this base isolation. First of all, let's talk about what base isolation is.
Well, I guess the best way to compare it, you know, it's hard to really to find a perfect analogy. But if you pictured building on an ice rink or on an iced over lake and there was an earthquake, the ice would move with the ground, but the building would move a lot less. You're really disconnecting the building from the ground.
And this is something that would almost inevitably reduce earthquake damage, but also prevent collapse of buildings.
Yeah, it would prevent collapse. And of course, I should say that our building code does target life safety. So our current building code, you know, says people should survive earthquakes, but it does not address the amount of damage that buildings have. And as a matter of fact, it's the opposite. Our building code actually dissipates or encourages the construction of buildings that dissipate the earthquake energy through damage. So we are programmed to damage our own buildings.
Our building codes are way behind the Japanese.
Well, they are in some ways. For instance, their buildings sway or they're restricted to sway half as much as ours are. Ours are more flexible. Theirs are stronger and more rigid. But, you know, it must be said they have 10 times more earthquakes than we do on the West Coast. So this is a necessity for them.
They also got a lot more frightened by the last earthquake because of the nuclear connections and so forth. But What's preventing us from moving this way other than cost?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think it speaks in some ways to our culture, to the way our construction industry is set up. In Japan, you build something and you feel a sense of ownership for it. You feel a sense of pride or shame if it fails in an earthquake. Excuse me. In the U.S., we have very quick turnaround for, you know, you might build something and then sell it 5 years later. We have developers who are really looking at the bottom line, and we have a culture that really looks at the bottom line. And in some ways, that makes sense on an individual basis. What are the chances that my particular building will be terribly damaged in an earthquake? Well, you know, the odds are probably in your favor because how do you know it's going to happen in your particular city? But from a societal standpoint, this is not a good way to go about things because you have the risk of a city becoming disabled, as happened in Christchurch, New Zealand. For years, the downtown of Christchurch, New Zealand was closed.
There was, in fact, I was there when it was it took quite a while for them to even get up and operating again. Somebody you talked to, Kit Yamamoto, talked about throwaway cities. I mean, that's really what we're talking about here, aren't we?
Well, it is. I mean, it's the question of do we want to build in a way that is usable after an earthquake? Right now, we're building to, I think we can say, a bare minimum. We're building just to be able to get out alive. Do we want to build so that after an earthquake and the inevitable aftershocks, earthquakes do come in clusters, do we want to build in a way that preserves the cities? And California is so different now from what it was when these building codes were conceived. California is dense. It's more vertical. We are much more vulnerable to earthquakes than we were, say, in 1906.
Well, the City Hall, and not only City Hall, but Apple down in Silicon Valley has these kind of preventive measures, this new technology, innovative technology. Also, Los Angeles City Hall, and it's noted, I think, an important, as you point out in your column, that a lot of museums and hospitals have this base isolation, but and so do many other countries, China, Turkey, and so forth.
Yeah.
The real problem is somehow to really motivate and get people off the stick here.
I think there's a real lack of awareness. I think most people do not, and rightly so, study the building code. But I think there's a sense out there that the building code is more protective than it really is. That if my building is up to code, then I'm okay. But in fact, the building code is just a very minimal protection, and we are encouraged, and this is the way our system works. The government says, okay, well, here's the minimum, and then, you know, you can always make it stronger if you want. That's a major difference with Japan, where the government has, you know, mandates for more protective systems, but also there's just a greater awareness in Japan. You know, it was fascinating to hear about, like, the ads in the subway in Japan, or I saw some commercials on Japanese television. When you advertise a condominium in an apartment, you can get a premium if your building is seismically protected. And of course, we don't have, I mean, here you'll see an ad for a condo and it'll say, hey, you know, it has marble countertops and and flowers in the lobby and a swimming pool or whatever. But we don't advertise the seismic safety of our buildings the way they do in Japan. So there's that awareness piece.
Talking with Thomas Fuller, San Francisco Bureau Chief of the New York Times, and let's hear what you have to say about this. And particularly, you'd like to hear from some developers or people who are living not only in houses that may be endangered because this new technology can happen. In fact, Tom, let me just get the figures from you because they're in your article. I'm going to give out the phone number. But you're talking about, for example, a 7-magnitude quake. We're talking about what kind of damage to homes and buildings potentially?
Well, there's a study that came out last year that estimated that a quarter of all buildings would be disabled in the Bay Area immediately after an earthquake. Now, a lot of those will be repaired. A lot of those will come back online. But you can imagine what that would do to the Bay Area if a quarter of all homes and offices were disabled. And, of course, there's the earthquake insurance question. Only around 13% of Bay Area homes are insured, and many fewer buildings, commercial buildings, are insured for earthquakes.
So I think your article said 8 out of 10 homes, 9 out of 10 buildings are uninsured.
Are uninsured, that's right. Yeah, so it's around 10% insured commercial buildings in the Bay Area. And so really, I mean, that's very striking. I mean, in some ways you can't blame the building owners because earthquake insurance is so expensive, even for a home. I mean, I insure my home in the East Bay, and it costs $3,000 a year.
Of course, a lot of this is big turnover when it comes to building ownership and so forth. That plays into it, too.
That definitely plays into it. That's the cultural piece of the way that there's a disconnect between the risk that you have as the owner of a building and the risk that we have as a society.
Let me get our listeners involved in this. Why we're not building seismically safer buildings is really the question that looms over this whole discussion. And Tom Fuller is here with us. to enlighten us, particularly when you think about the contrast to Japan in terms of what has not gone on here. We'd like to hear your thoughts and like to hear any questions you might have, and you can join us now at our toll-free number. We invite you to do that. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. That number again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. I should mention that there was some state legislation which was at least in the works, and Jerry Brown, former governor, vetoed it.
That's right. Yeah, there were two pieces of legislation last year. One would have created a database of vulnerable buildings, because right now, how do you know that your office building or your condominium is structurally vulnerable? You'd have to go down to City Hall. You'd have to look at the blueprints. You'd have to then hire someone to. So there was a bill that said, hey, let's put together a list. That was vetoed. And then another bill would have called for, it was quite watered down, would have just studied the possibility of strengthening the building code to have buildings functionally usable after an earthquake, and that was also vetoed by Jerry Brown.
Let me just ask you also about sway or drift, depending on who's using it from what lexicon. More damage potential with American building codes, because they allow for twice as much, essentially, drift as Japanese codes.
Well, that's really interesting, because San Francisco now has a proposal, and I haven't gotten a really clear answer on where it's going, but there's a proposal to meet the restrictions of Japanese drift. So in other words, drift, picture, you know, a tall building in an earthquake will sway back and forth. And the more that you sway, the more, as you said, potential for damage there is. The Japanese code calls for about 1%. That's hard. In other words, 1% of the height of the building you can sway back and forth. And our restriction, our code, has it around 2%. So there is a San Francisco proposal to make our buildings twice as rigid, I guess you can say.
Another problem that needs to be seen in this whole equation is there's no government mandate. I mean, when we compare to Japan.
Yeah, I mean, so the building code is this very complicated document. It actually comes from several different sources. Again, it's a minimal standard. I think a good comparison is to healthcare.
This is an American idea of individual choice.
Yeah, individual choice. In other words, as Americans, we kind of debate how much should the government tell us what to do. And so where we've ended up with the building code is we've decided the government should protect our lives. Now, the building code says that there should be a 90% chance that the building does not collapse. So that, you know, is the protection part. But the building code does not go beyond that. It doesn't look towards the resilience of the building and of the city. And now there are many engineers in this, what they call a resilience movement, who are saying, hey, let's look at this question. Let's strengthen our building code. So that debate is going on, just as it's going on with healthcare.
I've often thought when buildings advertise that they are earthquake safe, they're either self-deceived or they're fooling the public.
Right. Engineers will always tell you that earthquake proof is not something that exists.
Let me go to our callers, and we begin, Jake, with you. You're welcome to the program. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'd like to point out that the code currently has us designing. I'm a geotechnical engineer. The code currently has us designing to a 2% chance of a return in 50 years for an earthquake magnitude. So that's about a 2,500-year return period on the size of earthquake that we're designing to. So I'd just like to point out that while we are, you know, aiming to protect life safety, I think it's worth noting that the vast majority of earthquakes that are going to be seen in any building's lifetime are not going to be the design level earthquake. They're going to be significantly smaller. My second point is just a comment on how developers value you know, their own money over life safety, in that I actually am working on a building right now that is going to be built on base isolators here in the Bay Area, but it's a data center. It's not an apartment building or anything similar. It's a data center showing, you know, where developers' priorities lie in terms of spending the extra money.
Okay, let me thank you for those comments and go to Tom Fuller. Tom?
Well, you know, that's such an important point, the probabilities that we have in our built into our system. So the engineer referenced these return periods. You know, what is the likelihood? Basically, what we're trying to calculate is, what's the likelihood that a particular building will be struck by an earthquake, and how strong will that earthquake be? There are a number of people. There's a very prominent professor at Berkeley who thinks that our probability system is really broken, that that this is not something that is knowable, that earthquakes should not be that we can't use probabilities to know when the next earthquake will come. There is this mystery to earthquakes. And as any seismologist will tell you, when you ask when will the next big one come, they will say, yes, it will come. I can't tell you when. So I think there's a disconnect between the seismologists who say, yes, we will get a big earthquake, but I have no idea when, and between the engineers who have this system of trying to calculate. And I don't blame them. I mean, we need some kind of numbers. The engineers are saying, give me a number. I need to know how strong to build this building. And the seismologists say, I'm sorry, I can't give you that number.
We'll go to another caller, and that's you, Elena. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I'm just wondering, I think you touched on this briefly. I apologize if I missed it, but I'm wondering what the political scene is around changing the building code. Is there any kind of lobby around it? Are developers opposed to changing the building code? Like, what's going on there?
Yeah, well, during the debates over these two bills last year in Sacramento, you know, one of them involved strengthening the building code, and there were indeed the real estate industry, developers were opposed to it because it would increase costs. I mean, let's talk, for instance, about base isolation, the system that we've been talking about that disconnects, in some ways, the building from the ground, disconnects the shaking that's happening on the ground from the structure itself. That would cost around, you know, 5, 10, 15% more. So there's a cost element. And look, I mean, all of us in California are very sensitive to this. Housing is so expensive to begin with. So there is politics behind it. But on the other hand, I do think that there is a growing consensus, especially among engineers, that we do need to look at our building codes and make them more resilient.
Elena, I thank you for the call. A reminder to listeners, we're talking with Thomas Fuller, San Francisco bureau chief of the New York Times, who wrote an article on seismic safety and comparing here in San Francisco Bay Area to Japan, and we'll get more calls aboard here. Let me go to Berkeley and welcome Karen. Karen, you're on.
Hi, thank you. I live in North Berkeley in the hills, and I have a creek behind my house. I've been told that the Haywood Fault goes directly through that creek. So my question is, I have a very old house, about 100 years old, that has earthquake jacks that were installed about 30 years ago. Now, I've been told that makes my house extraordinarily safe in a large earthquake. Would love to know your thoughts on that.
Oh my goodness! This is my engineering degree does not exist. In other words, I'm a reporter who's spoken to many engineers and seismologists about this, but I feel like I really shouldn't give any comment on the particulars of the situation, except maybe to say that when you speak to engineers about wood frame houses, you know, the single family houses that we have in California, they are generally resilient. So it's good. You're, you know, it's a good place to be when the earthquake hits.
Good luck to you, Elena, and I thank you for the call. The bottom line here, I think, Tom, is we could save billions of dollars in reconstruction costs when the inevitable one hits if we just grab the bull by the horn, so to speak, here.
Right. I mean, so there are federal studies that show this, that preventative measures would save us billions of dollars.
And that includes retrofitting. It includes base isolation. And it includes simply being smarter about seismic safety.
Well, you know, it's funny. I arrived in San Francisco 3 years ago from a posting overseas, and I looked around and I said, I wonder if we really have a handle on the seismic safety of these buildings, given the building spree, the building boom that we've had in San Francisco. And I have to say, I do think it was a missed opportunity to have these discussions about, for instance, tall building safety that came about in the wake of the Millennium Towers problems. There was a tall building study that happened then. These discussions about, you know, resilient cities, it's a shame that they didn't happen before we had these building booms in both, you know, L.A. and San Francisco.
Here's a listener named Brett who writes, what are the thoughts around utilities impact? If an earthquake takes on our water, gas, et cetera, that will leave even the safe buildings non-functional.
Right. Well, there was the Haywired study last year, which the USGS led. And one number that really popped out at me from that was that it will be more than 200 days before full restoration of water after a 7.0 Hayward earthquake. So absolutely. I mean, this is the problem with talking about resilience. We say, you know, great, the Apple headquarters, you know, which we can talk about is this, state-of-the-art resilient system. And if you're in that building, great. But what about your home? What about your commute there? What about the water and electricity to the region? What about mass transit? All of these things, it's almost paralyzing to think about.
Hugh wants to talk about schools. Hugh, join us. You're on the air on Forum.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to know how safe our schools are. A few years ago, KQED had the On Shaky Ground series about how underfunded the Department of the State Architect was, and it really helped us advocate for getting our local public school, which was seismically unsafe, rebuilt in Glenview, Oakland. But it makes me worry about all the other schools in California.
Well, public schools are supposed to be built 25% stronger than normal homes, and then hospitals 50% stronger. So we do have a law that mandates stronger construction, but there have been shortcomings. I know among some private schools there are questions about this, there's also the older schools that need retrofits, etc. But the law does call for stronger structures for schools.
Let me thank you. We got seconds left here, Tom, but let me get a response to you. Ben writes, even if there are building codes and regulations, why are so many tall buildings being built on fill, which would be especially susceptible to liquefaction? Millennium Tower is a good example, but the proposed large-scale buildings on Treasure Island seem like an unreasonable risk as well. Is this a zoning and land use problem as well as a regulation one?
Right. And of course, downtown San Francisco and SoMa, that is also an area vulnerable to liquefaction. There's a question, even if the building is secure, what about the area around it, which, liquefaction is when the soils are vulnerable to kind of collapse.
We're vulnerable to time here. Thank you so much,
no
Tom
worries.
Fuller.